Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. How are you doing today? I am really looking forward to this program. I look forward to this program every week, but I've been trying to get at least one of my guests on this show for a while, and I'm so glad we could finally work out a moment to do that. I'm sitting here in the Progressive Radio Network studio and smiling for a photo at the same time. I have with me Joyce Friedman and David Korupkin in the recording room here with me. And they are from the Voters for Animal Rights organization. Now, you may remember a few years back, I had Allie Feldman Taylor on the show when she had just founded the Empire State Voters of New York, I think it was
Empire
called.
Empire State Humane Voters.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you changed it because that was always hard for me to remember. Empire State Humane Voters. Right. And then shortly after that, they really took a brave move and changed the name to Voters for Animal Rights, really telling it like it is. Because, you know, it's interesting, Empire State Voters for New York, or as I mentioned before, Humane Voters, as I guess there was one incarnation of it. The word humane is kind of questionable these days. I don't know what it means, because it doesn't mean the same to me as it does to other people. And humans are often not very nice, at least maybe half of us. Right, so let's get right to it. I want to introduce you to my two guests. I have David Korupkin here, and he's a lifelong Brooklynite and dedicated advocate for animals and coexistence with wildlife. Among other pursuits, David founded Goose Watch NYC in 2011, and during the past 7 years, he has been involved with numerous efforts to protect threatened wildlife living in NYC through activism, legislation, and policy. Under his leadership, Goose Watch NYC organized successful campaigns, notably including the documentation of USDA Wildlife Service roundups and killing of Canada geese in New York City parks, pivotal in encouraging the city to move towards non-lethal goose management policies, as well as passage of legislation to stop the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation's plan to eradicate mute swans in New York State, and the prevention of USDA's killing of Staten Island's wild turkeys by helping to coordinate their relocation to farm animal sanctuaries in upstate New York. Goose Watch also worked to protect deer on Staten Island and coyotes in Queens, and participated in the campaign to ban wildlife performances in circuses. As a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, David has assisted with many rescues of injured geese, raccoons, squirrels, and pigeons. David graduated from Brooklyn Law School in 2015 and has served as a aide for New York City Council member Daniel Drum, legislative director of New York State Assembly member Linda Rosenthal, and assistant law clerk to the Honorable Justice Catherine Levine in the New York State Supreme Court. That is an amazing amount of work. And now we're going, can't you wait to just hear from him? Yes, big applause. And now I have Joyce Friedman, who I've known for a very long time, and she has been everywhere all the time, quite passionate with her activism. She has extensive experience as a multifaceted advocate for animals, a former clinical social worker. Joyce entered the animal rights field as Northeast Campaigns Coordinator and then Northeast Director for In Defense of Animals. She gained expertise and began to see the value of legislative work and electioneering by serving on the board of directors of League of Humane Voters NYC. She then became program manager of the Surrender Prevention Program Pet Help Partners at the Humane Society of the United States, keeping thousands of animals in their homes and out of shelters. When she transitioned to become NYC coordinator at the HSUS, she worked on passing local animal-friendly legislation, most notably as a leader in the successful campaign to ban wild animals in circuses in NYC in 2017. Joyce currently manages a community pets program at a local animal society and is thrilled to be serving on the board of directors of Voters for Animal Rights, using her expertise, experience, and passion to pass laws to protect animals and to help ensure animal-friendly legislators are in office are her biggest priorities as an animal rights activist. Joyce has rescued dozens of dogs and cats over the years, and she currently lives with her three rescued cats, Pablo, Patrick, and Lucy. I need to take a big breath and bow in awe. You know, we're talking about lots of things in mainstream media today, and we don't hear about the wonderful and very important work that happens every day at a local level. The local work is probably more important than what's going on in the federal government, which is a circus, a scary circus at that. And so I'm just thrilled to be able to talk to you both. Thank you, David and Joyce.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us, Karen.
Whew. Okay, I'm out of breath. Now you talk.
Well, I will just say that the chaos at the federal level does create some opportunities at the local level.
Yeah.
We're getting involved.
Right. Well, I want to inspire every listener, because if you're frustrated as I am, this is where the work needs to be. You need to get involved more than ever in your community, and maybe listening to these two incredible activists will inspire you and give you some ideas about what you need to do where you are. Okay, so let's talk about the Voters for Animal Rights and some of the important campaigns that you're working on. Go.
Well, first I'll say what our mission is and what we basically
Great.
Aim to do. So we aim to help elect candidates who support animal protection. We lobby for strong laws to stop animal cruelty, and we hold elected officials accountable to humane voters. So our most sort of obvious and visible goal and form of our activism is to work on having animal rights legislation introduced and then passed. What a lot of folks don't know is we also are behind the scenes and more working to gather activists to join us in building a humane voting bloc. And we are based in New York City, so right now our focus is on New York City legislation and New York City elected officials. We do also support New York State animal protection and animal rights bills as well, and who knows what we may end up expanding more in the future. But building that humane voting bloc is so important. If we look at the NRA and if we look at other at animal exploitative industries and other industries harmful to people, harmful to the environment, harmful to animals. One of the reasons they're successful is because they have a strong voting bloc in favor of those horrible activities. So what the animal rights community needs to do, and what Voters for Animal Rights and our wonderful founder, Allie Feldman Taylor, knew long ago, which is brilliant, is that in addition to the very useful and needed protests and other forms of animal activism, what was seemed to be missing in New York was not only working on legislation, which is so important, but also holding elected officials accountable and getting animal-friendly folks in office so that they pass laws such as this.
Absolutely. So important for the animals who are, in some sense, voiceless. I mean, it's kind of hard for them to get an attorney to represent them, and we need to do that for them in this crazy world that we live in.
Well, that is one of the things that Voters for Animal Rights is very focused on, is building that voting bloc that Joy spoke about and organizing New Yorkers who already care about animals and want animals to be treated well. We need to amplify those voices. We need to make sure that those voices of humans who live in New York City are heard, and so that when government is making decisions that negatively affect animals or could positively affect animals, that the people who care have some input in the process.
We got an interesting council growing in New York City where a number of them are vegan.
Yeah, I would say, see what David thinks, but I would say that we have the most animal-friendly city council currently in many ways. Unfortunately, most of the city council will be gone soon for the next round of elections. However, we still have them for about another year and a half. But yeah, there are some vegan council members. Do you know who?
Helen Rosenthal.
Councilmember Helen Rosenthal is vegan. Councilmember Fernando Cabrera is vegan. And both of them have been wonderful and truly supportive of animal rights legislation.
Right.
Because of the work of animal advocates in New York City over the past decade, if not two decades, we now have an environment where it's cool to be for animals. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to hide your veganism. You can tell people you don't eat animals and still win elections.
Right.
That's right. And in fact, elected officials look to us for endorsements, which is one sign that this is a very important thing to be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. So what are you doing?
Well, before we start getting into the issues, because Joyce did mention that we are losing some of our best council members in 2021 because of term limits, two-thirds of the council will be overturned.
Whoa, that's scary. Mm-hmm. Or that could be positive.
There are 51 members of the city council, and 34 of those seats will be open, and there will be a lot of people vying for those seats. We're thinking at least 200 individual candidates, possibly 300, maybe even 400 people who want to be members of the city council. So that's a big...
So that's an opportunity.
Opportunity and challenge. We want to make sure the best possible people get in.
And what do you have to do to get on the council? Could I be on the council? Who wants to support me?
You have to win a local election. The districts are divided by geography. Every couple of neighborhoods gets a member of the city council.
But what people don't know, most people, I think, is how powerful the city council is. You know, we point our finger at the mayor all the time, but it's really the council that makes the decisions, and they wield a lot of power over a lot of money, big budget.
Yes, and for a law to pass in New York City, first a law has to be introduced by a particular council member, or often two council members, and then that law has to, in order for it to pass, it has to have a majority of the city council, this is even before it gets to the mayor, vote. So we have 51 city council members, so we need a majority, which is 26.
34 if you want a veto-proof majority.
Right, exactly. Mm. So for example, with the bill that you mentioned in our introductions, the bill that passed 2 years ago to ban the use of wild animals in circuses, we actually had a supermajority. We had... Well, when it ended up passing, we had, I think it was 43 yes votes, which is huge. I mean, which shows how popular the idea of banning the use of wild animals in circuses, which is horrifically cruel, was, you know. But if a majority of the city council do not vote yes on a bill, it never gets to the mayor's desk. So, as you said, while the mayor is very important, and sometimes the mayor can introduce their own bill, it is really crucial that members of the city council are, from our perspective, in favor of protecting animals.
Yes, which is why it's so important to keep up on what your local elected officials are doing, because they make a tremendous difference. And I remember, too, with that circus bill, that up until the last minute, things were happening, and it was very tentative until it finally got signed.
Yes.
Yeah, anything can happen. Okay, so we've got a bunch of things to talk about. You're involved with foie gras and fur and rats and school programs and hatcheries, and what do we want to talk about? There's so many
Where
awful things
begin?
That we're doing.
Well, a priority bill right now is a bill to ban the sale of foie gras in New York City. And this bill, this issue has arisen in other locales in the U.S. This has already passed in California. Am I correct that it?
I think so.
Passed in
and
the
I
state
thought
of
it
California.
Passed in New York. Did that never happen?
No. So the bill to ban the sale of foie gras is a current bill in New York City Council that we're working on passing.
Okay.
And we actually have a majority of council members who have signed on to the bill, which means that they're co-sponsors of the bill, and we're hoping for a vote really soon on that bill. It's always a challenge, even after you get a majority of council members, let's say, to sign on the bill, to have a vote. So the council speaker needs to arrange for a vote to happen on a bill for it to pass, for it to have the opportunity to pass. The reason foie gras is so cruel is because so foie gras truly is it's a diseased liver, and it is a liver of a duck or a goose, which is intentionally made diseased in each animal to be, and it is ducks and geese are force fed on factory farms to have their liver grow 10 times the size of what it normally would be.
Delicious.
So it's liver disease, which, just like in a human, would be a horrible thing, a bad thing. You're not happy if you're diagnosed with liver disease. It's very painful. And the force feeding mechanism that is used is a metal or plastic pipe that is forced down the throat, into the mouth and down the throat of ducks several times a day. And it is incredibly cruel, obviously. The birds become very frightened and scared. Their whole existence is living in terror of when this is going to happen next, several times a day. Mm-hmm. And the workers who are tasked with feeding hundreds of thousands of birds several times a day are obviously not able to do this, even if theoretically could be done humanely, which of course it can't. So what happens is mistakes are made as well, and tears are made in the throat and the esophagus, and there are just so many obvious, very mm-hmm. cruel things about this. And research has shown a little more than just 1% of restaurants in New York City sell foie gras. So the passing of such a bill to ban the sale, to address the industry's arguments that jobs would be lost, is false argument, because there's no restaurant that just sells foie gras. It's a menu item in only about a little over 1% of restaurants.
And
so
they can
no
easily,
New York City jobs are to be lost.
They could easily substitute with delicious nut pâtés or something like that.
No, there's actually a product called faux gras, F-A-U-X, mm-hmm. which is plant-based and delicious. That yeah. replicates
the restaurant
it, right?
that you took me to in the village.
Oh,
have a fancy alternative.
They did. We actually ordered it that day. Yeah. It's a plant-based
pâté
version.
Faux gras is a delicacy. It is a very high-end product. It's not something that everyday New Yorkers eat. I've just seen surveys that show an overwhelming majority of New Yorkers are supportive of a ban. There are small pockets of individuals who clamor on their individual right to go and spend their money on this product of cruelty, and it's beyond unnecessary.
Yes, I lived in the south of France in the early 90s, and I had French friends, and one of them really believed in French traditional foods, and he was convinced that the birds enjoyed the process of being force-fed with a tube shoved down their throats.
That explains why they run away.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Why they run and video, undercover video by several groups of a New York State-based
Maybe New York
factory farm
don't
shows that.
Maybe the New York birds aren't as tough as the French birds.
I think the New York birds are tough too.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a horrible, horrible thing.
Yeah.
Okay. What else? What other horrible things are we doing in the city?
Well, before we move on, we'll just note that the bill is pending, and we're hoping that it will be voted on. The speaker has indicated that he may or may not be supportive. I guess we're waiting to see how quickly it moves and whether it will have a vote and whether it will be allowed to be sent to the mayor.
Okay, action item, folks. If you live in New York City or you know people who do, have them contact their council members and tell them to vote for this ban on foie gras, okay?
That's correct.
That's your first assignment. Next. And you know, if you don't live in New York City and you live somewhere else, you might want to start a foie gras ban where you live.
That's a great tip. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. We do hope to inspire other cities, mm-hmm. and we also are inspired by other cities who have done similar legislation.
And if you don't know how to get started, you can go to the Voters for Animal Rights and make some connections.
Yeah, and we encourage you to email us with questions about how you can do similar work in your city. So we also are working on a bill to ban the sale of another extremely cruel product sold in New York City, and that is animals' fur. A lot of people say real fur versus fake fur. So I like to say animals' fur, because the fur belongs to the animals. Mm-hmm. That's animal apostrophe. Yes, an animal's fur, animal's apostrophe. And fur made from other materials is real as well. It is anything you have in your hand is real. And animals' fur belongs to animals. You know, it doesn't belong to us. And trapping, gassing, anal electrocution, these are all horrifically cruel, obviously, methods of by the fur industry to steal the fur off of animals so that it can be worn. Another, quote, luxury product that's completely unnecessary. And there are so many alternatives.
I think in the feedback that I've heard since this bill has been on the agenda in New York City, no leading elected official has posited that fur isn't cruel. I think everyone is basically in agreement that it is cruel. And so at least we've gotten over that hump. And the question now is, what do we do about it?
Right, right.
When I think about fur, I think that a lot of things are cruel. And one of the natural follow-ups, if you're going to ban fur, then why not ban leather? And I think, personally, you should. Like, is leather as necessary as fur is unnecessary? I don't really know. But I don't know if the ones who promote fur bring this up or if they realize they're opening a can of worms. If they do, oh, let's not mention some of these other horrific products that we support.
Well,
right.
No, they use the slippery slope argument against us and try to instill fear that we're not just going to be satisfied by banning fur. We won't. We're coming for your leather after that, and you name it. So they are aware, and they try to call us out for various hypocrisy, I suppose, or other kind of flaws in our argument for why fur should be banned.
And that's often a diversionary tactic, right? So it's an interesting statement that they make, because so then are they agreeing that leather, using animal skin to wear leather, is cruel too? Or on some level, they're acknowledging that as well. The slippery slope is a common debating technique and argument. I mean, the thing is that in 2019, and this is true 2018, 2017, et cetera, but I'll say in 2019, it is completely unnecessary to use any animal products. That's why I'm vegan. It is not necessary to take the life of an animal and before that cause tremendous suffering and torture to a living being who is no different from your cat or dog, who I think most people will say that they would not want to harm their cat or dog, and any other animal feels the same amount of pain and fear. So to answer your question, yes, in terms of legislation, we can't prohibit everything at once. We can't work on everything at once. There is a precedent for foie gras, for example, the sale of it being banned elsewhere. The number of countries, but the sale of it has been banned in several, many European countries.
Israel
has banned the sale of foie gras.
Scandinavia, I've heard some of the countries.
I think it might
Europe
be a dozen. I'm sorry.
Don't have the list
handy. I'm prepared with the number. But back to fur, I do want to also clear up the misconception that some elected officials appear to have, or maybe they're not realizing when their constituents are upset about this bill, is it is not a ban on wearing fur. People who own fur coats obviously can still wear their fur coats. It is a ban on the sale of new fur.
And I think that's an important point, because again, we're talking about fashion. We're talking about luxury fashion often. I think people in New York City are used to seeing, and we're not just talking about full-length fur coats that are from minks or chinchillas. I think especially that comes to mind now are the Canada Goose with the trimmed coyote fur, and coyotes are wild animals that are trapped in New York State and elsewhere in neighboring states and Canada specifically so that their fur can line in $1,000 luxury item that doesn't keep anybody warmer than any other product. The fur trim doesn't keep anybody warmer than without it. And often people on the street are asked by activists to just donate that fur trim to a wildlife rehabilitation center. There are a lot of reasons not to wear fur, but Canada Goose in particular, the fur trim is nothing but fashion. It doesn't keep you extra warm.
That's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. And it does zip off. And one form of amazing activism done by some amazing activists in New York City and elsewhere is what David said, doing outreach and educating, sharing information with people. A lot of people who buy Canada Goose coats with that fur trim do not know that it comes from, I don't know what they're thinking. They may think it's fake, or they're not thinking about it. And when they are shown videos of coyotes who were trapped often we'll start crying and we'll realize, oh my God, this is terrible. And then it is suggested to them to zip it off and donate it to sanctuaries for animals. So,
which is not to say that the down feathers inside of those jackets
is any less cruel. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's especially pointless.
It's a decoration. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I get it. Yeah. I've read that some of those trims, maybe not for the Canada goose coats, but come from dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
dogs. Right. You like your dogs.
And coyotes are also canines, mm-hmm. right? But you're right, in terms of domestic dogs
and cats.
We don't
like coyotes, because coyotes eat our cats, right?
Well, the interesting thing about that, and maybe we'll talk about wildlife later, but there have been a lot of recent studies that show that killing coyotes does not result in a net reduction in their population. Mm-hmm. It has the opposite impact.
Wow.
Usually there are more coyotes than when you started, once you start trying to kill them for pest control or fur.
Yes. So, David, is that because there's an absence of them, so they feel
they overcompensate.
Overcompensating in terms of giving birth. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to get to wildlife, so I hope we can do
He's
that.
He's our expert right there.
Yeah, I see that. Awesome. Okay, so that's animal fur. And again, contact your council members in New York City or anywhere you live and tell them how you feel about it. I hope you're against it like we are.
We do, yeah. We really do encourage New York City listeners to call their council member, New York City council member, and urge them to sign on to and support the bill to ban the sale of fur.
Yeah, and of course I've read that there's backlash where people say they'll be losing jobs and it's kind of against their tradition or all kinds of good excuses.
Again, the bill doesn't ban you from keeping or wearing
original furs. And we're not going to pour red paint on those original fur coats. Those the ones they have.
I've never poured paint on anyone.
I haven't either, but that's what people remember. Mm-hmm. The PETA campaign, the anti-fur. And
there are places you can donate your older fur coats. Wildlife rehabilitation centers are happy to take them. And I think during the winter months, Buffalo Exchange runs a donation drive of old fur, and they donate that. So
that's nice.
There are animals in need that could benefit from fur that people are no longer using. And with, you know, rising temperatures, may not need the fur coats in your closet.
Exactly.
Excellent. Exactly. Okay. What's next on your list?
Do you want to talk about the rats?
I may bring up our wild bird bill, the pigeon bill,
for a moment.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. So there is another bill that it appears might have a vote soon. This is a bill near and dear to my heart as well. This is a bill. It's called. This is bill would protect wild birds, particularly pigeons, in our city from being illegally. It's already illegal. From being illegally captured in these horrific nets, which injure them, often break their legs or wings, and then those birds, those pigeons, are purposefully caught in these nets and transported to Pennsylvania to be shot in pigeon shooting contests. Mm-hmm. And the time from between when they are pretty much taken from their urban wild habitat, where they have family and where they live in parks, on our sidewalks, etc. They are kept in small boxes. They're not fed or given much water, if at all. And they're kept in dark boxes like that for a couple of days to disorient them. And then in Pennsylvania, in a few towns where it is still legal, it is illegal to do pigeon shooting contests in New York City, but it is still legal. Pennsylvania is really the only state actually now that actively does, and where it's legal, these horrific shoots. And then the birds are sort of let out of these boxes to fly where they could barely fly at all at this point because of their weakness, and then they're shot, you know. And this is fun for adults.
Fun for all.
And children are involved also in it, and it's really horrific. You can Google and read a lot about the biggest, most notorious one was called Higgins, the Higgins pigeon shoot, which I hadn't been involved in, but a lot of activists were years ago in going there and either protesting and also trying to help the injured birds who didn't die right away. That Higgins shoot ended finally, but there are still other ones. So what happens in New York City now is to capture pigeons in this way is a crime, but it's only a violation, a very low level crime. So if arrests are made at all by the NYPD, it's sort of like getting a traffic ticket, and the person pays a fine and comes right out and does it again. whereas this would make it a misdemeanor. The council members we have spoken to and showed just like a two-minute video of the horrific netting, like immediately agree this is awful. And wonderful council member Carlina Rivera, who we forgot to mention, has also introduced our foie gras bill. So council member Carlina Rivera, she replaced council member Rosie Mendez, who covers several downtown areas, including the Lower East Side. And Rosie was the main sponsor for 10 years of the bill to ban animal circuses, which ended up, as you know, passing, along with then council member Corey Johnson, who's now our speaker. They were the two main sponsors, but credit to Rosie for sticking with it for so long. So Carlina Rivera is wonderful. She's very animal friendly, and she has introduced our bill to ban foie gras, and also she has introduced this bill to the wild bird bill to protect pigeons. So we're hoping for a passage of that bill very soon.
You know, pigeons are New York's quintessential wildlife. If you didn't know how intelligent and otherwise amazing they are, you should stop by the Wild Bird Fund, where they have rescued and rehabilitated pigeons. I get lots of calls as a wildlife rehabilitator, people asking for help with pigeons, but not enough people realize how special they are and how fortunate we are that we have pigeons in New York City and elsewhere, but particularly here, where you may not have the experience of seeing wild animals in your everyday life. Pigeons are an amazingly important species. We sure do. So protecting them is a very important priority, and talking to people about why they're important is something I enjoy doing.
Yeah, that's true. And I want to remind people, if I'm correct, David, pigeons are doves? Are they a type of dove? Or
they're, I believe, a rock pigeon or rock dove is their, scientific name.
Right.
And they come from the same line of birds, and there are lots of different types of pigeons.
Right. So I mention that just because in terms of, you know, how as a society we've been taught that certain animals are wonderful and to be respected and loved, and other animals are to be used or killed or exploited or thought of as pests. So if all the pigeons on our streets and in our parks and in trees were all white and looked like the doves that symbolize love, and people may, which is also inhumane, release them at weddings and things like this, pigeons would not be treated or thought of the way they are by many people.
Pigeons need better marketing.
And when I believe it was Woody Allen said that pigeons were rats with wings, on the one hand I curse him, but also I love rats.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
His intention was saying they're just that rats and pigeons are both bad, but actually we love rats and pigeons. There are many pigeon lovers in the city, and that's why you'll see a lot of people feeding them, et cetera. Whether people enjoy pigeons or not, they still should agree they shouldn't be harmed and taken from their environment. So.
Excellent. Okay, can we talk about rats?
Sure.
I guess that's a good set.
Yeah. So I read about a month ago or so, forget when it happened, but so we have what's considered a rat problem here in the city. Most urban environments do have large rat populations, and there's lots of reasons for them. I think the big problem is the human population, and we are encroaching on all wildlife places for other animals to live. That's number one, but what are we going to do about that? So let's talk about rats.
Well, I would just start by acknowledging, to the extent that rats are in people's homes, in their apartments, in their walls, in their ceilings, we should want to help those people and make sure that they can live in a clean environment that doesn't have wildlife in their walls and ceilings and coming up their plumbing. So
absolutely,
we all share that goal. And if I had rats in my apartment, I would be yelling at my landlord and my city council member. But the solution is not just to kill or to kill even. There is no reason to think that killing rats as the sole approach to managing this problem is going to help anybody.
Why is that?
Well, all right, let's take it a little further back. Karen, you were talking about how people are driving the rat problem, and it's true. The places where you see people suffering because of the presence of rats, A, We're talking about dilapidated housing. We're talking about people who are who don't have a lot, who maybe live in public housing that's been not just underfunded, but like billions of dollars neglected for decades. The rat problem is not a new problem. It's just something that every couple of years politicians decide to take seriously again. But we have not seen, first of all, it hasn't been solved in 600 years. People are complaining about rats every day, and it never seems to go away, no matter how many rats get killed. Right. I wonder why that is.
So some of the focus should be on improving housing that is so dilapidated.
At a starting point. Prevention, making sure that there are no entry points, and to the extent that they're already in our infrastructure, to build them out, to find ways to separate and exclude them from the rest of the infrastructure. Where people live. I think if you don't like rats and you don't want to see them on the subway, tough shit. They're on the subway. They live all around us. The next thing that we're seeing in New York City is the sanitation problem. There is no way to not have rats if you've got garbage on the street. It's just not happening. You have to cut off their access to food. And if you don't do that, you are guaranteed not to get rid of the rats.
So how do we do that?
That's another good question. And we have some ideas and suggestions, but we know that there are people who are thinking about this in a very comprehensive way. And New York City's sanitation department and policies are extremely complicated and need to be dealt with at a very high level.
It is linked to so many things. I mean, I think about the food waste, and food waste is linked to excessive greenhouse gas emissions, climate change, and where there are so many people that are hungry. We throw out in New York City so much perfectly good food. I just think of the bagels that are thrown out every night because they can't be sold day old the next day. And the rats know about it. The freegans know about it and take some home. But it's a big problem. So anyway, so Eric Adams, the Brooklyn Borough President, who I think has done some wonderful things, and he's promoting great things about plant-based foods in schools and around the city, he came up with this plan of drowning rats.
Well, I don't want to speak for the borough president, but I was home watching. I was looking at my computer, and I got an alert about a press conference that was happening. And the next thing I know, I saw the borough president with a couple other elected officials waving dead rats, which they had pulled out of a new contraption, which they were gloating about because of the way that they say that it effectively was killing the rats. I was pretty upset because I think that as much as we want to address this problem and help people who are suffering from rat presence, that bodies are not going to do the job, and that it was an unfortunate press spectacle. And thankfully, advocates who were upset about it, and thankfully there were many of them. In fact, we were getting inundated that weekend because we weren't the only people who saw this and decided that we would send a letter to the borough president, which outlined, first of all, our disappointment in the display of these dead rats and the way that that was presented, and the fact that advocates who, you know, we know the borough president, they could have, he maybe invited us to have a conversation about this, and we have some ideas and suggestions, which, you know, the elected officials are free to leave at the door, but, you know, we do have some ideas about addressing the root causes, some that I mentioned, and I didn't even tell you about the I think the most recent reports that we've seen show an extremely high correlation between the presence of rats and gentrification or development. And in Brooklyn and other areas around New York City where you're seeing the most complaints about rats are the places where you're seeing the most construction, the most rapid high-rise buildings going up. And because of the process of digging up and excavating rats are being driven out of their burrows and they're being pushed up onto the street and pushed into other places. And so that needs to be thought about.
Right.
And I'm not
thought about ahead
sure
of time.
The extent to which that is being thought about. And I know that people are complaining about the results of that. And I know that people are very upset about gentrification, about development. But we have to make these connections and we have to think, you know, bigger about how we live with wildlife and how we plan for wildlife.
Okay, I want to make sure we get to this one subject, and that is using live animals as school science projects. It may not seem like an obviously big thing to talk about, but I think it influences the students in many different ways. I'm thinking about when I was in school, and I had a friend who did a science project, and it affected me for the rest of my life. I don't know about anybody else, but he put a frog, a live frog, under ether, and then opened it up and attached like a wire to its heart and then strung it up so you could see a stick move from the heart beating. I was horrified.
Do they still do that?
I don't know. That was a long time ago. But anyway, tell me about live animals with school science projects. What are you doing?
Well, I'd have to check and see what the status of live animal vivisection in New York City schools is, because I don't remember doing that. We did have dead...
We could talk about dead animals,
dead
too.
Dead frogs in my high school.
Because
class.
They were alive, and then they made them dead for the project. So
sure. So there's a lot of, you know, money and business involved in getting those dead frogs to your classrooms, right?
I will say about that, about dissection, a law passed in New York State, I don't remember the year, to allow students to have choice. So it's dissection choice, so which is great. Mm-hmm. So students can not be penalized by saying to their teacher, you know, I don't want to dissect, even if it's for this assignment. So I just wanted to throw mm-hmm. that in. And activist in New York City, Patrick Kwan, good friend of mine, he was instrumental in getting that passed when he actually worked for the organization I used to work for, HSUS, and mm-hmm. he was a New York State director at the time.
This is a good advance, but I think we need to go further than
of
that
course,
for lots
yeah.
of reasons. I mean, right. there are all those frogs that are being raised and then killed to be dissected. So, and then the,
right,
and
but then you're mentioning, of course, live animal use.
Mm-hmm. And then, right. But then the students, too, they have to go the extra step and come out and say, I
right.
don't want to do this.
Right, and not all students are
that,
empowered
but,
to,
yeah.
or they may fear being penalized, mm-hmm. et cetera, of course.
Obviously, yeah. I think you're 100% right. And mm-hmm. I think now, more than ever, at least in my own life, I think there's a newfound acknowledgement and understanding that the old ways of doing things are not necessarily, or in this case, definitely not the right ways. And for example, you know, we're questioning how much do students even learn from doing this? What is the takeaway value? Do they walk away understanding the biology of a frog or a cat any better than they would have if there were some, technological alternative? I don't think so. I think there are lots of zoos, for example. I mean, I think this week we saw a lot of news about a woman going into the lion's cage, and one of the takeaways for me is that a lot of people who were standing around thought she was part of the exhibit. How much are people really learning at the zoo? It's unclear. But this, for example, vivisection in school, I think another one, and we can talk about this later if you're open to it, is the hatching
yes,
projects.
Let's go right to it.
Because we should follow up and see what the status of vivisection in schools is, because we should have a robust conversation with the Department of Education and make sure that it's not enough for students to have the option to opt out, and especially with hatching projects, which I'll explain. But we need our principals and our teachers to be, I mean, we need everybody who's involved in education to be up to date on humane education laws, which have been on the books for 75 years and are not followed or enforced. We want children to learn about animals and why it's important to treat them humanely, and to also have education on a myriad of subjects that don't involve cruelty. And we can impart the lessons without using and exploiting animals in the process. So one of those, I remember having a hatching project when I was in kindergarten, The hatching project in the classroom, it's an incubator, and eggs magically appear, and I've since learned that they're bought from hatcheries and shipped in mail. Sometimes, I'll get to this, but sometimes they send, well, frequently they send live animals into the mail, and you have to go to the post office and pick up your box of live chicks. But in the case of hatching projects in New York City, they are sent eggs, mail order, from hatcheries, and they spend, you know, 4 weeks or so until the, and they rotate the eggs in an incubator, and they learn about the process of the, you know, development of life in then the eggs hatch, and they get to see these cute, adorable chicks. And then what happens to them is anybody's guess. Sometimes I've heard from teachers that they are sent back to where they came from, which probably doesn't go very well for them.
Put them in a box, seal it up, and ship them back.
That's what some have said they do or have done, or is what they're told they should do. In my experience, they end up in parks. They're dumped on the street. They end up, you know, in random places, because what do you think is going to happen? And people think that, oh, they're ducks, so they should go in a park, without thinking, A, they're domestic ducks. They're not wild ducks. They don't have the survival skills. They need to be fed. They're susceptible to predators. Guess what? They didn't have a mother. They were born without a mother. So how are they going to know how to survive in a park? So now you're talking about wildlife rescuers who have to spend hours for consecutive days, if not weeks, trying to trap, catch these animals, and then find homes for them at sanctuaries, all of which is extremely burdensome and time-consuming and expensive. And in other words, wildlife rescuers are picking up the tab for school teachers and principals. You know, they are doing these projects, and there's no way to ensure that they go well. And I don't think they should be happening at all. I don't think there's really any clear benefit. I don't remember what I learned from doing an incubation project. And now I'll tell you the part where I did get a call from a principal asking if I could help, because she had 10 ducks, and she didn't mean to order the ducks. She meant to order the eggs, but she got instead 10 ducks. Mm-hmm. So could I take the ducks so that she could reorder the eggs she wanted? Because she wanted to do the hatching project. She's a principal of a school in New York City.
Hatching sounds and like so much fun.
I tried to explain to her, no, actually, you probably shouldn't do that. And also, I'm not going to participate in helping you do that.
And here's why. And then have 10 more ducks in a few weeks.
She was not happy about that.
Yeah.
And probably has continued to do hatching projects in her school every year since. And I don't know if there's any way of getting through to these principals administratively, or if we have to pass a law to stop them from doing it.
Yep, you have to pass a law. Obvious. Change doesn't happen. That's why what you're doing is so important. I'm always talking about how all of us need to adopt a plant-based diet, go vegan, reduce the amount of animal products you use, because that's a powerful thing, but there are lots of things that are happening where we need to change laws, pure and simple.
Yeah, the reason animals are mistreated and killed is because it's legal to do it. So ouch. We have to make it illegal.
I think it's both. I think the law is both a cause and an effect. It reflects our values, but it also tells us how to act going forward, and it sets a standard for how we act. And
that's
so
true.
A lot of the work that we do in trying to enact legislation, for example, a ban on the sale of foie gras, this is not something that's tyrannical. 80% or higher of people who live in New York City support a ban. The same is true 81%. On a lot of these issues. We're codifying what people already think.
If you do an interview on the street and you ask dozens and dozens of people if they agree or disagree that animals should be treated with respect, what do you think the answer is?
I say, of course.
Right.
Of
exactly.
course. Now, where can I get my chicken nuggets, right? So they don't connect the dots.
It's a balancing of people's interests and their wants and their needs. And I think even though we want to live in a world, we meaning the three of us in particular, and also people who we're advocating on behalf of and our constituencies, we want to live in a world that's free from animal abuse and exploitation and treating animals like inanimate objects that are just byproducts of our existence. We want that, but we also understand that to get there, we're going to need to bring people together and to make sure that people who are in government, who are making decisions about how government works and how everything that it touches works, reflect what we want.
Right, so we have maybe 4 minutes left. Time goes by. There's so many things to talk about. Is there something that you'd like to mention that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, let's make sure that those who are listening to this broadcast understand that there are things that they can do in their everyday life, and that they're also, at this point, especially given as we discuss the chaos in Washington, I think an onus and a responsibility to get involved and become part of local action. And it doesn't have to be with Voters for Animal Rights, though we invite you to become a member of our organization, to follow the work that we do and participate with our efforts and help guide our efforts, because we're responsive. We're not just doing things because we, Joyce and David, think they're great. We're going off of consensus, and we think the work that we're doing reflects what people in New York City want. And so we really have to encourage everybody on every front to get active and to get involved.
Yeah, and to follow up on that, for folks who want to read more about what we do and get involved, or even just make sure you get alerts when bills are coming up to call your council member, you should visit our website, vfar.org. That's VF as in
Voters
for Animal Rights, VFAR.org. And if you just sign up there, that means you'll get our action alerts. We won't overburden your inbox. Most of our alerts are on social media, so we also ask you to follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. So Voters for Animal Rights, VFAR.org. Also, just as a note about what your program is about food, and it is easier than ever to go vegan, and there's a great website that I really recommend. It's called challenge22.com. Challenge22.com is trying vegan for 22 days with online support, others mm-hmm. doing it the same time as you, and tips and tricks. And it's really a wonderful experience. And I really encourage folks to just Google vegan recipes. And again, it is easier than ever to be vegan. And it's really living your values. If you think animals shouldn't be treated inhumanely, then we shouldn't be eating them. So,
we still have a few minutes. I'm watching the clock here. Can we just touch briefly on pets, companion animals? I know that you've worked quite a bit and you're currently doing some work with community pets programs. Could you just talk about some of that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely, yes. So I've been very involved in what we call surrender prevention. So the whole idea, and I am a former social worker, and that sort of ties into this, people who give up their pets to shelters generally do not want to. They are often faced with circumstances in their life or even with their animal, which they don't know how to resolve, and they feel the only only action they can take is to give up the animal. So surrender prevention in the community pets program that I'm involved in at Animal Care Centers of New York City, that I used to be involved in at HSUS, is providing free and low-cost resources to folks, especially folks living on a low income who have their pets and love their pets and need help with either veterinary care or free dog training or free cat behavior expertise, possibly help in a crisis where they become evicted and they need to bring their emotional support animal in to live with them in the shelters, etc. So supporting folks and keeping animals in the homes they already have. Animal Care Centers of New York, ACC, has a wonderful admissions surrender prevention program and community pets program where we try to have folks who think they need to give up their animal actually walk back out with their animal or keep their animal when they call us needing to give up their animal. Animals who already have homes should stay in the homes they're in and provide help and support to those folks. So that's really what that's about. And it's a very non-judgmental approach. Of course, there are some people that just have no connection to their pet and don't want to take our resources, or maybe are in a position where they just cannot. We don't have the resources to help them. But so many people really do accept and want that help and really have a connection with their pet. And that's really the focus of sheltering. Now the movement forward is to help animals stay in the homes they already have with support.
It's great to hear about all the programs that are available out there and all the people that are doing hard work to make things better for people and for animals. Just before we go, favorite food, favorite places in New York City where you like to eat, maybe vegan breakfast, or what's your favorite? I love to end on a happy, delicious note.
I just went to Black Flamingo, which is this new restaurant in Brooklyn. It was off the charts good. I definitely recommend it. I had like nachos with cashew cheese or some kind of nut cheese, and
there should be a vegan
tacos.
Nacho competition. There's so many great places to get them. Yeah,
it was absolutely awesome.
Black Flamingo,
I think that was the name.
So I live in Queens, and there's a great restaurant in Rego Park called Green Zemphany.
Yes.
It is an all-vegan restaurant, huge menu, Asian food, absolutely delicious, plant-based meats, other delicious food.
We're there really all the time.
Great. Yeah. I give a shout-out to them, and there's probably over 150 vegan vegetarian restaurants in the city that people can enjoy.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for everything you do and for joining me today on It's All About Food. I'm so glad we got to do this.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Okay, everybody, thank you. You've been listening to It's All About Food with Joyce Friedman and David Karupkin of the Voters for Animal Rights. I'm Karen Hartglass. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Email me at info@realmeals.org. Everybody, have a delicious week. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.